You're never out of school. So today I thought, well, actually this was suggested to me maybe by Alan, who happens not to be here, so leave it to him to give a suggestion for a topic and then not show up. But it's really a part two of what we did previously, which was putting things in context. This is called The Next Question, and we're going to really talk about similar things to what we talked about last time, but last time we talked about misinterpretations due to lack of context. Today, we're mostly going to talk about lack of interpretation. So versus that, people just say, we don't know what it means, or, you know, don't bother with it, or it doesn't have any meaning, or it doesn't apply to us. Does anyone know what the picture painting is from? What biblical story? Cain and Abel, everybody knows. So that'll be one of them, which a lot of people do have interpretations for, but a lot of people say, well, you know, God just didn't like Cain's sacrifice. And that's that. You know, no, nothing more to it. So if we can go to the next slide to tee it up. The Bible often gives us limited information as to why things occurred. Sometimes this makes our interpretation difficult, which is our subtext. And we can keep going. An example of an incorrect interpretation, which is where we were last time, was, you know, your doctor telling you that sugar intake is making you sick, which maybe it is, but for this example, we're going to say that that's the incorrect interpretation, as opposed to your doctor saying, I don't know what's making you sick, right? Which is not an interpretation. Each can be dangerous. And so I think we can keep going. Well, we will slow down eventually. But to start it up, we have a couple questions. The first is, why is it important that we have interpretations of biblical stories? And maybe even preceding that, is it important that we have interpretations of biblical stories? That's open. If anyone has ideas, feel free to raise your hand. The simplest one is it important that we interpret biblical stories? Everybody says yes. Does anyone know, have a reason for why? Sure. Yeah. More, a lot of what we talked about last time. It's important that we have an interpretation, maybe to fight back against an incorrect interpretation, as Chuck said. Anybody else? And you don't need to answer. The next one, I don't think I have an answer for, but maybe one of our scholars does, is a wrong interpretation better than no interpretation? Meaning, is someone taking last time that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me? Is someone saying, you know, that they can fly or something ridiculous? Is that better than someone saying, it's just, you know, words on a page? Doesn't really mean anything to us. That was for him 2,000 years ago. I'd say probably not, but I think that's open. It really depends on the story, the interpretation, and all that. And the last one I think we do have an answer for is, do we need an interpretation for every Bible story? And maybe interpretation isn't the right word there. Maybe it's, do we need meaning for every story in the Bible? Sorry, what did you say, Chuck? I can. Is this just recording me and not projecting my voice?
It's recording you.
It's not actually. Oh, okay. I thought that was making me louder as well. I guess not. So, but I don't think I need it. I wasn't raising my voice. Thank you. I wasn't raising my voice because of that. So the last question was, do we need an interpretation, or do we need to get meaning from every biblical story? Michael says yes. My answer is probably not, and maybe I'm wrong. So I think if we can go to the next slide. We'll start there. I don't think anyone can really get the full meaning of every biblical story because we don't live when it happened. And it's okay not to know everything. Some stories are just literal descriptions. And maybe the answer is yes, as Michael said. I would say I'm not sure it's possible to get it, and I'm not sure every story has a lot of meaning for us. But Michael, you said yes. Reaction.
I said yes. based on the fact that we may not know and understand the true meaning of every story, but there is one.
Yep.
That's why I say this.
True. Any, Chuck?
It depends on your personal filter, the way you view things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some interpretations or meanings might have been useful for people when the story was told that aren't as useful for us. It would be useful for us to know it, right? But again, maybe we can't know it because we weren't living back then. But might be more useful for the story to whom it was originally told. So the first question, which was why is it important that we have interpretations of the Bible? I added a few here. I know, Chuck, you said to sort of fight off bad interpretations, which I think is true. The ones I had were biblical stories teach us about God is, I think, the most straightforward answer of to why you would want to know biblical stories and get meaning from them. The second one is they teach us about how we should live and act. This is more related, I guess, you think of Sunday school stories and teaching children morality. And what the Bible stories mean and how to trust God. Thirdly, they teach us about our heritage as Christians, you know, knowing the history of Christendom, whether it's more recent or biblical times, is super important to your worldview. But left it open, there's, I'm sure, a bunch more. So does anyone have any other reasons why it's important to get meaning out of the Bible or specific stories? Terry?
I guess this goes out to teach us about God, but Jesus said that all the Old Testament is pointing to him. So in some way, all of the biblical stories are going to be pointing to him. You talked about the Sunday school lessons, like, you know, you're David, and, you know, what's your Goliath that you have to, have to slay? But, like, in that story, that's not what's... That interpretation is not what's pointing us to Jesus.
Yep.
You're not David. You're also not Goliath. You're the people that are just like on the sidelines looking for, you know, for the champion to actually come and save you.
Yeah. Your math quiz in the morning is not Goliath. Right. You know, the two are not equal, even though the teacher might be Goliath, but no. Anybody else reasons of importance for getting meaning out of biblical stories?
The Bible is written. The language of God is pattern and symbol. That's his language. So as you read through the stories, there are always patterns and symbols that come up over and over and over again. And they're all meant to do just exactly what Terry said, point to God, point to Christ. And if we don't have good interpretation skills, good biblical interpretation skills, we miss the patterns and we miss the symbols, or we associate them wrongly. Some people don't associate them at all. They just say the Bible's literal and just take it for what it says.
Yep. Very good. The next question that we asked was, is a wrong interpretation better than no interpretation? This one I think is probably better answered as why is a lack of interpretation dangerous? We'll get to this in our first story a little more about why it can be dangerous, but if anyone has any ideas that jump to their head, why not having an interpretation of David and Goliath or a different story might be harmful to you. And I think Michael, he used the example of misinterpretations leading to a bad outlook. I think lack of interpretations can have the same bad outlook. Sort of just recapping this, Alan actually, when he said that I should redo this, he said do something on Jordan Peterson. And he was asking me about his situation, but I don't always follow him. But it is interesting that he has now two best selling series, even though they're on YouTube, so selling is not the right word, but very popular series on Genesis and Exodus. And he's just done Exodus. And his approach, so it's comical in that he's, I'm not going to judge his salvation, but he is not a proclaimed Christian, but he believes in God. And so he takes the view of these stories have great meaning to us for the sole reason that they've lasted for 2,000 years, right? His point is there's a reason that these stories have been around for 2,000 years and stuck with us. And there's a reason that they're the bedrock of multiple faiths. And he's not a self-proclaimed Christian. So even from the rational, let's say, reader and not Christian, we don't even need to say atheist, the rational reader, you know, these stories have meaning and are important. So I think we covered those. So we can go to the next one, which I think we've talked about hermeneutics before. I haven't been to seminary, so I won't get too detailed. But there are four, at least four types of hermeneutics, which are principles of biblical interpretation. So getting meaning out of story, literal, moral, allegorical, anagogical, / mystical. So this, I think, can be summed up as, in what way does this Bible story or the Bible have meaning to us? And I think that most stories probably fall into more than one of these buckets. It depends on how you take the story, but the first one we'll talk about is Cain and Abel. And I would say that probably has at least literal and moral ways of being interpreted. Allegorical, probably. The anagogical, mystical, I don't know. So I'm not even going to get in that one, but I would say at least the first two, probably the third one. Does anyone, I have it on the next slide, but does anyone want to try to assign a story into allegorical or anagogical, mystical? Sian? Yeah, the prodigal son. That's a great one. Good. And what about mystical, which is probably the hardest? What's a Bible story that we say, and it can even be a wrong interpretation. So, you know, this is a hermeneutic, which isn't always appropriate. So think about bad theology for this one. Or maybe not bad, out there theology. Yeah, what would be a mystical? So that's the story, right? When we say mystical or anagogical hermeneutic, we say the rich man represents, it's sort of like an allegory, but it has mystical meaning. So the rich man is in hell, and that represents, you know, us suffering. So that story is a story, and maybe it'll be easier if I just, oh, Terry. So
there was a common interpretation of, like, the Rahab, the prostitute story, where, because she let down a scarlet thread, a red thread.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Rapunzel's hair, the Jacob's ladder, is the red thread. That's a good one. Does that make sense? On the next slide, I had the example of crossing the Jordan River is going into heaven, and that's a mystical interpretation. Maybe it's also allegorical. Over time, it seems to me, maybe this is right, maybe it's not, that Christianity has moved their hermeneutic more and more to the right. Anyone can disagree with that. That is my high-level analysis. But all these are important ways that we can interpret Bible stories. So I think we can go to the next slide. Two examples I wanted to look at that often go uninterpreted. The first one, I think, is people just don't want to deal with it. Right? People just sort of say it is what it is. The second one, I think, is more people are just bored. Or genealogies, you know, you get to that part and you're like, it's not really that important. And not to say that, you know, no one interprets these, because scholars do. But I think your, let's say, your average Gary Viet doesn't. Just joking, Gary. So we can go to the next slide. Does anyone want to read this? I'm happy to, if not. So this is Cain and Abel. So, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering. But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall his desire be, and thou shalt rule over him. And Cain talked with his brother Abel, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother, and slew him. So a lack of reason for the story. To me, there's at least two things that jump out is, if there's no reason, it's like, how are we going to learn from one of the first stories in the Bible, right? So there's a narrative gap. We get this story and it's like, it's just a story, is really like first murder in the Bible, right? And it doesn't have meaning for us. The second one is a theological gap, which, if you don't interpret the story or try to make sense of it, is really like, is God rational? Because seemingly out of the blue, God rejects one and accepts the other. You know, it says, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. So it seems like God is complicit, is probably the right word, in Cain's murder, or in Cain killing Abel. Because Cain does that because God irrationally says, I'm not accepting you, and I'm accepting your brother. What hermeneutics apply here? I think at least the first two, literal, moral, maybe allegorical, maybe mystical, that I don't know about. But any other, I guess, things that a lack of interpretation could lead to with the story? Gary?
The reader would have to assume that Adam is doing what God wanted him to do, and sacrificing the sacrifice that God wanted, and calling it sin.
Abel.
No, Adam. I mean, I'm going back. Cain and Abel must have observed
Very good. I agree. And I think that's one of the correct interpretations, which on our next slide, we'll see. So the first one, as Gary, do you want to come up and, are you sure? The first one is really, I don't know that we have proof that Adam, maybe we do. Do we have proof that Adam was already doing blood sacrifices? I don't think we do. I think you're right. I think you're right. I just don't think that we have any other proof that Adam had already done this. But we do have at least one example of God doing it, which the first example is God already laying out the necessity of blood, right, when Adam and Eve sin. You're probably right that, and unless anyone disagrees, you're probably right that Adam had done it. and Cain would have seen it. But certainly he would have known about blood being necessary for the payment of sins. It's really, you know, one generation. It's Cain and Abel would have heard the story, you would think, 1,000 times about the fall and blood being sacrificed to atone for that and them getting clothes out of that. So that's at least one reason, I think, that you can get from the story. The second one is that when Abel brings forth his sacrifice, it does say he brings forth the firstlings, which if you think of like tithing, you know, the first of all your increase, the 10%, the best fruits, that sort of vein, that Abel brings forth the firstlings of his flock. And for Cain, it just says he brought forth of the fruit of the ground. It doesn't say he brought forth the best fruit or the biggest fruit or the firstlings of his fruit. And I don't even know how you would describe it, but it just says the fruit of the ground. There's no modifier. And for Abel, it doesn't just say he brought forth of his flock or, you know, and of his flock and the fat thereof. It says the firstlings. So that's at least another reason that we can assign to why Cain's sacrifice was not acceptable. The third reason is that it appears, both here and in Hebrews, that Cain didn't really put effort, which sort of ties to the second reason, but Cain didn't really put forth effort into his sacrifice. Here in Hebrews 11:4, you can look up, but it basically says that. this one, in the verse later, it says, "If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted," which seems to imply he didn't do well, which is very vague, but you know, it very well could be that he didn't put a lot of work into his crop or brought forth, you know, if you have to give up some fruit and veggies, probably give up the ones that are moldy and you can't eat, right? I don't know if that's the case, but it certainly is a possibility. Any other interpretations, meanings people see with the story?
I think there are two that I can think of. And the one is that Cain's sacrifice was, I believe Hebrews talks about being faithless. And so without faith, it's impossible to please God. Mm-hmm. And that faith, that Cain really didn't put any faith or trust. And so it's easy to bring fruit instead of what you're supposed to because you don't care. The other is, and maybe this is your allegorical kind of thing, brother killing brother is what we do. Because Christ is our brother, and we're happy to kill him over and over and over again when we want something we're told we're not supposed to have.
Yeah.
Or we want to give into the flesh rather than obey the spirit. And so we don't want to put ourselves in this category, but we're Christ killers.
Mm-hmm.
We're brother killers.
No, I like that. And the faith one I'm interested in, I don't think you were saying this, but it almost sounded like you were saying that Abel had faith that he was doing, that his sacrifice was doing something and Cain didn't.
Correct.
Yeah, that's interesting. Gary? Mm-hmm. A trade, yeah.
And he wasn't going to do that. And
took the dust of his sowing and told God, this is for you, this is my best.
Yeah, it's a great point.
That's interesting only if Cain's a vegetarian, right? Because I'm sure he went to his brother and got meat.
Yeah.
If he needed meat.
But he didn't give it up.
He didn't do it for God, though.
Yeah.
Only did it for himself.
Yeah. And I think one allegorical mystical, you could tie in Jesus as a shepherd, right, being killed. And Abel was a shepherd being killed for someone else's sin, right? Terry?
So one allegorical interpretation, if you look at it, we always like put all of these bad things onto Cain and say that he was like so terrible. And he was when he killed his brother, but like before that, so he was a tiller of the ground. So he brought what was from the ground. It doesn't say it's a sin offering, it's just an offering. And you know, God does order grain offerings in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. So it could just be that this is life. Like sometimes God doesn't do for you what you want him to do for you. And the human heart has become so evil in one generation that you know, people are just jealous because sometimes there's a reason that God didn't want to bless your grain, but he wanted to bless this guy's whatever he's doing.
Yeah. That's a great question, and I don't think we know the answer. Did Cain sin before he killed his brother? Some people will say yes, right? And we have hints that he might have because the first fruits and not a blood sacrifice. But a lot of people, and I think the point of bringing this one up is a lot of people say, oh, it's just a story we don't really know. But we have hints here. And I don't know if anyone has conjecture on if was Cain's sin in the story the killing of his brother? Or is that his second sin, and his first sin was his sacrifice?
Another aspect is Cain and Abel had sinned.
Had what?
Sinned.
Yeah, already, yeah.
They inherited it from the parents.
Yep, from Adam.
It was a disease, obviously. In order to, God is saying to the whole New Testament, or Old Testament, right into the New Testament, for that sin, you need blood.
Yep. So these are all things that, you know, if you're not interpreting the Bible, you're missing. We can put it that way. One thing that's interesting that we won't get into, I think, is that the last verse here, a lot of times I think we think of just Cain being so angry that his sacrifice wasn't accepted, that he just goes and kills him, right? But it actually says, and Cain talked with Abel, his brother. And it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. We don't know what they said. But if you're, you know, on a murderous rampage, you usually don't talk to somebody, right? So something else happened here when they talked. And we don't know what it was. Maybe it was some of the words Mr. Lapp said earlier about not having our slides ready. Anything else on Cain and Abel? So I think next we can go to genealogies, which can be one of the most boring parts of the Bible. I don't know if anyone listens to the Bible, but when you hit these, they seem to go on forever. Anyway, we have two... is everybody familiar with this, that there's two main genealogies of Jesus, and they don't really match? And we might have talked about this in some sermons. Right, one is from Matthew and one is from Luke. And a lot of people just say they're different, you know, we don't know why. But we do have, just like with the Cain and Abel story, I don't think we have a clear answer, but we do have multiple reasons or interpretations that allow it to make sense that there's different genealogies. So one of them has 77 and one has 42. I know it says 41 there, and we will get to that in a second. Does anyone know why there's 42 and the 41? Or at least most scholars count them as 42. You knew at one point, right? You can go to the next slide, Mr. Lapp. Thank you so much for doing this, by the way. What a great job you're doing. This just shows the difference in the two genealogies, what's missing and what's there. And we can keep going to the next slide. Thank you. There's at least three possible explanations. Sort of like Cain and Abel, I have my own opinions of which one is true and makes the most sense, but there's at least three out there. One is that Luke is showing Mary's genealogy. The second one, which I think is more likely, is that Matthew is showing the kingly genealogy, the royal legal line of Jesus as king, whereas Luke is showing the physical actual genealogy. And then the last one is that Joseph had two fathers, one natural and one by law. And that comes from the story of if a brother dies, right, and his brother marries his wife. And so people say that Jacob and Heli were two brothers that had married the same woman. And that woman had given birth to Joseph. So those are some definite possible explanations. If we go to the next slide, I think we can get a clear image of why at least one of them is probable. The 42 generations are because Jeconiah is often counted twice because he was king twice. And it's pretty clear that there was intentionally 42. The first reason is that they're broken up into sets of 14. Three sets of 7 times 2. And in that, the author, Matthew, removes the wicked kings, or the most wicked kings in Israel. So it's clear that he's taking out the bad guys in the royal line of succession and saying those weren't good kings, that he's not tying them to Jesus. So I think that's pretty clear. David's name also has the numerical value of 7. So he broke it all up into really 3 groups of 14, or 6 groups of 7. He omits the bad kings, the especially wicked kings. Whereas Matthew gives 77 generations, which, again, is a significant number. I think it was actually last week that we talked about where in the same book, in the Gospel of Matthew, and sorry, I read Matthew at the bottom, Luke gives 77 generations. In the Gospel of Matthew, there's the story of how many times should we forgive sins. Some texts say 77, or interpret it as 77, and others say not 7, but 70 times 7, right, which would be 490. But some just say 77. And so it seems clear that it would have significance for Jesus to be the 77th generation, both because of the number 7, but also because of the number of times sins are forgiven, Jesus being the 77th generation from the original sinner. And maybe there's something there and maybe not. So I think there's a few explanations here, at least for the reduction in the number of people in Matthew's genealogy. But many people will just look at these two and just say, we don't know why they're different. Some people will even say, it's an error. But I think if you look a little bit further, you'll see that there's certainly reasons or interpretations that you can get that account for these the discrepancy in the two genealogies. And I know we're not talking about Revelation, Michael, but that 77:1 was what really tied in to me. I sent Michael a video earlier. There's a video of Morgan Freeman, of all people, on BBC. The most recent text of Revelation was found in 2005, and it has the number of the beast as 616 and not 666. And all before that, there had been a few versions that said 616, but most people said it was transcribal error. Now the oldest version we have says 616. We're not going to go into Revelation, but many people interpret 666 to be Nero because the numerology of the name adds up to 666 in Greek. 616, the point of the documentary with Morgan Freeman was 616 actually adds up to, or Nero's name in Latin adds up to 616. And so they're describing the same person, even though it's two different numbers. Whether or not that's true, you can look up the video on your own. But that certainly reminded me of that. And I think the last slide is really where I wanted to end, of why it's important to do what we're doing here, or to do it on your own. Comes from Proverbs, and it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. And so when you're interpreting the Bible and putting things in context, that's what you're doing. Those were all the slides I had, but I'm happy to take comments or questions or negative feedback. Terry?
Can you go back a slide, just for the genealogy? I never understood the right marriage one, because if you look, so maybe Jacob and Hallie or whatever.
Yeah, Hallie.
Okay. Like, maybe they're two different, but then they have to, if they're two different ones and they have different genealogies, they have to be half-brothers, not real brothers. And the half-brother would have to be the father, because they're going by the father. Father has the same name, so they'd have to have two different fathers, both named Lefan, who are brothers, so like their mother had to both name them Lefan.
Yeah.
So it would be like a George Foreman situation, where like she names all of her.
Yeah. And the one in Luke is Mathat, but a lot of people say Mathat is the same as Mathan. But yeah, I agree. I don't like that interpretation. And I don't think I ever said it, but Jeconiah is counted twice because he was king and then he was exiled and then he was king again. I said I'd say that, but I didn't. But yeah, I agree. I don't love that. Anybody else? All right, well, I think we can get ready for worship. Thank you.